An article that appears today in an influential Jesuit magazine is drawing criticism from the lawyers of people who say they were abused by Catholic priests. The article says bishops are not responsible for abuse by individual priests, that church leaders should not inform congregations that priests have abused someone if they don't think it will happen again, and that priest superiors should not necessarily report such allegations to the police. Lawyers say the article by the Reverend Gianfranco Ghirlanda, a senior canon lawyer, conflicts with statements by the Pope, who has called child sex abuse by clergy a crime. Debates over the Church's response to sexual abuse have now been waged intensely, but long before the scandals about abuse within the Church dominated the headlines, it was public schools across the nation that were under fire for downplaying the problem of predatory teachers or staff. Many parents have fought to get schools to adopt safeguards. It's a fight that some parents don't yet think they've won. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Terry Miller's 20-year-old crusade against sexual abuse in schools began when she and her two young children moved to a small desert town, Pahrump, Nevada, 60 miles west of Las Vegas. Late one evening after an aerobics class, the instructor confided in Miller that she had caught her husband in bed with a high school student. The woman's husband, Joseph S. Peterson, was a teacher at Pahrump Valley High School.
The next day, I called the principal and repeated what she had told me to him, and he said there was nothing they could do about it. Without a victim coming forward, they could not do anything. It was hearsay and innuendo.
Rod Picarrett was the principal of Pahrump Valley High at the time.
We kept hearing rumors, and investigating and chasing leads, and were dead-ended everywhere we went.
Convinced that Peterson was dangerous, Miller kept digging.
And I found over 60 victims that he had violated in some form over a 20-year period.
Most of the girls that Miller talked to were no longer in school and reluctant to talk, so Peterson never faced any charges. But then, a school bus driver who had caught Peterson having sex with a girl on his bus came forward. When confronted, Peterson denied it. He was suspended from coaching, but Miller was amazed that he was allowed to continue teaching.
He still taught the computer classes, the typing classes, the yearbook advisor, senior class advisor.
And, says Miller, he was allowed to supervise an afternoon tutoring program. Years went by. Relentless in her search, Miller tracked down one of Peterson's victims and persuaded her to go public with her story of how Peterson had repeatedly raped her. It was 1996. Peterson had left teaching and was running for school board.
He was elected to the school board, and 2 weeks later, he was arrested on 3 counts of sexual assault, rape. He is in prison for life.
Miller had waited 14 years for this. Pretty incredible, but not uncommon, says Cheryl Shakeshaft of Hofstra University. Shakeshaft, one of the few researchers who has studied sexual abuse in schools, says exposing teachers, administrators, or coaches who have victimized kids can take years because it often involves a person who's well-liked, even respected.
People don't believe it. They see this teacher who gives up their time, and they see this student who may come from a family with problems, or the student has problems, and they say, oh, that can't be true. I'm not even going to bother to investigate that. And that's a big mistake.
According to Shakeshaft's groundbreaking research, most victims are junior high and high school girls. The abuser is almost exclusively male. Shakeshaft says these people represent a tiny percentage of school employees and teachers nationwide.
But each teacher may sexually abuse quite a number of students.
And when they're caught, says Shakeshaft, the rights of the teacher usually overshadow the safety of students. But there's a reason for that, says Julie Underwood, general counsel for the National School Boards Association.
I think this process is weighted very heavily in terms of protecting teachers' constitutional due process rights and their contractual rights.
Underwood says it's not uncommon for a teacher who's facing sexual assault charges to resign on the condition that the school district never disclose the reasons why he left.
If the teacher has left and they have not been proven to be a child abuser, there's no way for a school administrator to tell a potential employer that the teacher had in fact abused a child because it hasn't been proven.
Some states don't allow these deals. But just as in the Catholic Church scandal, there's strong evidence that many abusers go on to victimize kids in the next town or in another state. Today, at least 35 states require criminal background checks for teacher certification or employment. In a growing number of states, school employees are fingerprinted. Terry Miller, who successfully lobbied the Nevada legislature to make teachers' sexual abuse a felony, insists most school districts still don't adequately screen the people they hire, and too many school boards are still asking, what is sexual abuse and misconduct?
Coming on to a student, touching a student, sexually explicit, you know, conversations with students, are those grounds for dismissal? In my eyes, it is.
As president of Survivors of Educator Sexual Abuse and Misconduct, Miller says it's frustrating to read and listen to the news headlines every day and realize that sexual abuse in schools does not upset people the way the Catholic Church scandal has.
And I don't know where the outrage is. The Pope summoned the cardinals. Why isn't the Department of Education summoning our state superintendents? Why isn't the Department of Justice summoning our law enforcement agencies to get a handle on this?
Sexual abuse in schools may very well be a national problem, but the solution, experts say, is not in Washington. It's in state capitals and schools. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.